Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
That's two introductions around.
Randy.
Andrew.
Julia.
Nico.
John.
Jeffrey.
Angie. Last week we were 12. This week we're 6. It's so strange. Up and down and up and down. But it's always good, whatever happens. I brought you something interesting. We're doing a little piece of the Genjo koan that is a little bit more mysterious even than the rest of it in a lot of ways. Because it talks about the moon in a particular way. It goes, in seeing color and hearing sound with body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or the moon in the water. Okamura says we usually think we see things the same way that a mirror reflects. So this is me and that's me. Or that's the moon and that's certainly the moon down there in the water. But of course it isn't. Not really. It just looks like that. So when we're alive and well, all of our senses are deeply involved. It's not just our eyes, though we concentrate on our eyes. It's our ears, and we see with our ears, and we hear with our eyes, and we smell with our flesh, and the whole kit and caboodle has a different way of expressing and taking in. The more sensitive we are, and the more deeply we feel. So, he says, the analogies of a mirror and its reflection and the moon illustrate the unity of the self and all things. So, a mirror and the water aren't separate from the objects they reflect. There isn't any separation, but it's a difference. So there are different ways of expressing this, and I wanted to share with you different translations and to suggest that you take a look at the Zen site, which is a translation of all of Shobo Genzo, bit by bit. The Genjo koan goes through with, I've copied out 6 different versions of the same thing. So Okamura's, Waddell and Abe, Yasutani, Nishijima, Thomas Cleary, and Nishiyama. So, and those are just, that doesn't take Takahashi, Takahashi. And I'm sure a whole lot of others. But I thought you would find this very interesting.
So the Zen site is the website?
The website.
The website, all one word.
Yes. So it goes on. That's not the whole thing because the whole thing goes like this. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive that they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas and they continue actualizing Buddha. In seeing color and hearing sound with body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or moon in the water. When one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. My favorite image of this is the Taoist, the two fishes entwined with each other, and one is black and the other is white. So that when we're being body and mind, perceiving all things, it's not that we're separated from enlightenment, we're separated from Buddha nature in the least, but we're not aware. And as Okamura says, we're deluded. We're blundering around in our life as we live, going from place to place and doing what we can as the best we can. And we don't have to know, as Dogen says, our Buddha nature, but we can. And that the situation is such that there, it's just one being, but there are different aspects of the same being. So that we ourselves, when we are out and about, feel differently from how we feel when we're sitting for 3 or 4 days together. It's a difference of attitude and aspect of our own life and mind and body. We think of ourselves as one thing, one aspect, one personality, but there's so much and it's so big. When we sit, how big it is becomes much more clear to us. When we're trying to drive a car, it has to stay small. It's very interesting. The translation that I favor is the Nishijima. He translated the whole of Shobo Genzo with an English-speaking American and has copious footnotes in his work. So he's very helpful. He says, even if we use our whole body and mind to look at forms, and even if we use our whole body and mind to listen to sounds, perceiving them directly, our human perception can never be like the reflection of an image in a mirror. When we affirm one side, we are blind to the other side. It would be nice if it were all easier to understand, but I think what Dogen is pointing at is how easily we get caught in our small mind, you could say. Suzuki Roshi calls it small mind and big mind, and in a way that's a good analogy. And we forget, in a way, that there's a whole lot more going on here. And that it's a situation that requires something of us. Requires a great deal of us, really. It has to do with our connection with everything, how deeply we are connected with everything, and how much we are needed. We don't feel that so often when we're so distracted, but as we sit down, we begin to feel it. we begin to feel the pull of gravity and begin to connect with the sounds of the world, and we begin to sense the cries of the world, how much suffering there is. Okamura says, we are all the things that we experience. We are created by them. We think we make ourselves. This is my life. I've made it. I chose the food I eat and the furniture I sit on. It's my life. But if you think about it, actually, we are chosen by. And then we notice, oh, look what happened. We are all things. We are created by them. Without this relationship with all things, we couldn't exist even for a moment. In reality, I, you, and all other beings do not exist at all. Only relationships and interactions exist. So we live in community. Even if we live alone, we're living in completely in community, and we depend on the community for everything. And we are depended upon by the community as well. There are certain expectations, and just the way that we encounter others is a part of the sustaining of the whole system. We ourselves are a system within a system that is so big it takes in the whole universe. That's why we like to look up at night at the stars. We can feel it then. So he has a riff here about how human beings, although they're part of nature, have produced a society that has begun to grow out of harmony with nature. I'm reading a book about Alexander Humboldt, who lived in the early 1800s, who was the first one in the Western world to notice that everything was connected. He went to South America and he was just picked up things and looked at the bugs underneath. He saw a mountain and he just climbed to the top of it and began to analyze how the mountain was set up. And he began to write about it. And people got electrified by the information that nobody had had before. That there are different levels of growth and different kinds of growth on a mountain, that volcanoes exist and are alive, that continents, he actually was one of the first ones to say that Africa and South America fit together, that they used to be together and they came apart. Even though he didn't know how that worked. He was remarkable. He was such a hero that when he died, thousands and thousands of people collected in the streets of all the cities of the world. And yet we don't know about him at all. But he affected Darwin, who came a little bit later, and John Muir, and Emerson, Whitman, Thoreau, all of them were electrified in the same way about how we are living in nature as a part of nature, how miraculous it is, and how we're inadvertently destroying it. And so they were all extremely concerned. Some of them really, really, somebody I never heard of, Mr. Marsh, who spent his whole life talking about how the Greeks had taken out all the trees, so it's a desert now. That's what we're doing in America. And he was terribly concerned in trying to persuade people to think about what they were doing, and in despair that nobody was. It's a very curious situation that we're in. And it's related to our connectedness and our lack of connection, that because we've separated ourselves from nature as much as we have, we don't feel it in the same way. You know, they've done experiments where they send a bunch of people out into the city and then bring them back and test them and give the same test to people who've been walking in a park. And the people from the park ace the test. And the ones in the city can't do it very well. It affects our whole mind and body. And this is something that Dogen was talking about as well. This Buddha nature of us, he says, we don't practice individually, this is Okamura, to improve ourselves. Rather, we settle down peacefully within the network of interdependent origination and allow the universal life force to practice through us for all things. Coben always said, we're so busy, it just helps to sit down for a little while and realize that we are being sat, we are being breathed, we are being lived, even as we live and breathe and sit. It works both ways. He says, from one perspective, we are always living within the enlightenment of Buddha. From another perspective, no matter how hard or how long we practice in this lifetime, we will still be limited individuals. The reality of these two simultaneously true perspectives is truly wondrous. At all times, we have the potential to act with either magnanimity or egocentricity, to do either right or wrong. Both Buddha and demons are living within us, so we need to live our lives moment by moment, being led by vow. Which basically I think we do. In any case, I think we mostly do. I think most people try very hard to do the very best they can. And I would call that living by vow. And being sorry when we screw up and trying harder again. So, to be individual and universal at the same time. And to recognize both sides, to sit down every now and then and feel the universality of our life, the deep interconnection that we have with all things, even the stars and the planets. even the grass and the trees and the rocks, even our friends and our foes. And what an amazing, awesome thing it is to be like this. So that's this little piece of it. So there might be some questions about Okamura or Dogen or the translations, if you have a chance to read them, because they're a little different. Translation itself is a very curious thing. It's a whole subject in the literary universe. The enormous amount of disagreement about how to do it. Some people believe you have to translate word for word for word, and some people say you can't possibly do that because there's no word that matches exactly in another language that word. Every word is unique. So some people say, oh, you can just sort of get the drift and then just do a little riff on whatever it is. And some people say, well, you have to understand what the meaning of it is and then try to express the meaning of it. So you can feel that in these, how they're reaching for Dogen. And Dogen was writing in medieval Japanese that Japanese these days have a very hard time understanding. So it's a huge challenge. And it's only been thrown into English very recently. It's only about 100 years it's been in English. And Dogen wasn't really studied until recently, till the 1700s. They just hid his books at Eheiji and would bring them out once a year and air them out, marching around on the altar. They still do that. I saw them do that. And then they roll them up and put them away again. But then somebody started looking at him and just said, oh, this is really something. Maybe we should study this a little bit more. So that's what they started to do, and that's what we ended up with, is big fat books like this, and all of Shobo Genzo, and all of Dogen's poetry, and all of his teachings, and his little, it's amazing. And very helpful. Wendy?
Yeah, towards the end of your talk, you read that we all have the choice of acting from magnanimity or egocentricity?
Yes, that's Okamura's expression.
And that's our vow?
Well, that we usually try to do our best.
Well, we don't always try to be magnanimous.
No, maybe not, but we do have the choice to do that. And we often are magnanimous, even in spite of our selfishness.
I see.
You're thinking about people you know who are not...
You bet.
Not very nice.
So, what is the vow? to make the most magnanimous choice, or what?
It's not about judging other people, because we can't. So it's about you. All of this is about you. You can't project it on others. It doesn't work. It's about taking it inside and finding the truth of it in you only.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty egocentric.
Well, sure, we all are. And that's the point he's making, too.
I see.
And we embarrass ourselves and struggle with it. What I'm saying is that we intend mostly to do well by others. And knowing you, I know that's the truth for you.
True, but it's hard to make everyone happy all the time.
Oh, impossible. Impossible. Nobody's happy all the time. Nobody.
So we're faced with decisions on what to do.
Moment by moment by moment. There's no overall picture. It's just right now. What we can do now.
So then on reflection, when you evaluate your actions, just do you even go to I could have done, or maybe it would have been better if...
Copen always said there's no should be kind of thing. It's too late.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, you can notice it, but it's over. So better just to keep going and see what happens next.
Yeah.
And be surprised. It makes life very interesting that way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Andrew.
Yeah, can I jump off of that? What? You the sutta, the one on the better way to live alone?
Yes.
You know that one.
I know about it.
Oh, it's pretty simple, right?
Yes.
It's the only one I keep in my wallet. I keep it with me all the time. That's all it's on the topic of the past and anxiety about the past and anxiety about the future. But yeah, you know, it's my favorite sutta. About should-be's.
Should be.
But yeah, you read it after.
It looks pretty small to me.
It is pretty small print, yeah.
About
five.
Should have been younger.
Yeah.
Read it to us.
Well, I'll read a paragraph.
Please.
So he basically said, the Blessed One taught, I will teach you what is meant by knowing the better way to live alone. And then skip all the stuff. And then it says, do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has not yet come. Looking deeply at life, it is as it is in the very here and now. The practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must be diligent today. To wait till tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? The sage calls a person who dwells in mindfulness night and day, the one who knows the better way to live alone. And then Buddha goes over, what does it mean to pursue the past? What does it mean to not pursue the past? What does it mean to lose yourself in the future? What does it mean to not lose yourself in the future? What does it mean to be swept away by the present? What does it mean to not be swept away by the present? And the gist is, you know,
okay.
there's only the now.
There's only
the
now.
Author in the
title? Oh, it's a a sutta with the Buddha.
With Buddha.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's from the Pali Canon, I think.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That's good.
Okay.
I've forgotten where it is anymore.
Yeah.
But,
it's in the the Pali Karasa Sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya.
Okay, the Nikayas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's my favorite. It's why I keep it, because I get caught up all the time.
Yes.
About should-haves. Or,
yeah. Or what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nico.
We just did an Ango period of Jikoji, and that very sutta was the one that we read every morning.
Oh.
Just about every morning.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
Yes, Eric... chose that and he printed it out. He was doing his Shusa ceremony. And so we just like sat with that. So and it's very short, so we chanted it because it was got us
beautiful.
It got us going faster because it is so short.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah. And the better way to live alone is what you're saying, like the small me, big me, but there's another person in you.
Yes.
Another. You don't want to have two people in you, one that worries about the past and one stuck in the now.
Yes. Can you tell us about the program?
Which program?
The Apple program.
Oh, okay. So I'm first time here, but I've been running this Buddhist community at Apple, in Apple Inc. And so I've been here to meet Angie, and she'll be speaking next Thursday to the Buddhist community. And I've been at Apple 10 years, and I don't know how much you guys know about the history of Apple, but you know, Steve Jobs was a student of Coben's, and I guess you guys probably go back a little bit.
Yes. yes, I knew it.
Yeah. So is it pretty cool that I got connected with Angie, and excited to have her speak to a large audience next week, and we've been doing this. Only for the last year, but we've had a whole range. I mean, it's not Zen only, it's all this interesting American East-West collision of Buddhist philosophy and practice. We've had like Tibetan monks come, we've had Richie Davidson from the Center for Healthy Minds at University of Wisconsin. He's been studying long-term practitioners and the neurological effects on neuroplasticity and epigenetics, how your hormones and things regulate. So he came, and then we had like Robert Wright, who wrote this really great book that's just out of paperback, Why Buddhism is True. It's more of a game theory, like win-win versus lose-lose economics approach and evolutionary psychology look at how meditation can be powerful practice to solve a lot of present problems we face as a society, tribalism and just biases. And then we're having Angie. And, we have Frank Ostasevsky recently. Do you know Frank?
Yes. I've met him.
Okay, he's co-founded the San Francisco Zen Hospice and, in 87, and he spoke on death and dying and what the living can learn from the dying, what the death teach the living.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Yeah.
There's a good video of him giving a Dharma talk at SFTC.
Huh.
It had me in tears. It was incredible. If you go back in history of their weekly
feeds,
they had
yes.
him on video.
Yes.
He was really wonderful.
I might have been at that one, but he gave another one at the Long Now Foundation, Stuart Brand. And that one has the video, and he has a slideshow that goes really well with that. So actually last week he gave that talk at Google last week, actually, because I connected with him with some people. And that will be on YouTube, actually. They record all the talks at Google, so that'll be pretty cool. So anyways.
I'm curious, what's the size of the group that we have?
So there's like 1,300 people that across, we have 25,000 people at Apple, but it's not like we don't meet every week or anything, so it's just really to gather around these speaker events. So
great.
Maybe 100, 200 people, 300 people show up to an event.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So you guys are all welcome to come next week, but your whole like, Sangha, no, there's plenty of seats.
Yeah, come and hold my hand.
So that sounds like something next Thursday at noon. You guys are free.
Cupertino?
Cupertino down the street.
Is this at the new building?
It's not at the new building. Old new building. So okay. We have an auditorium where a lot of the old products were announced. And it's large. It's like 300-person auditorium. We'll have at least some seats. So let your Sangha know.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Oh yeah, and then just make sure they contact me so I know what to expect. Let them, you know, and then let me know and figure out, make sure everybody gets to the place. Okay,
we can do that.
Yeah.
You probably have to have permission to enter.
No. But it'd be good for me to track where everybody is so it's not all... because it's the auditorium's in a sort of a public area, but people might get lost and go to the non-public areas.
That would be very bad. Very bad. Well, it's after 8, so we should stop.
Okay. 1 minute sit.
1 minute sit.